Coming to you live on Registry Matters, a huge shout out to our stalwart patrons. The dynamic duo of Michaels, the tenacious Denise, staunch supporter Dale, and rock solid John. Without you, this episode wouldn't be possible.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and, well, another West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 346 of Registry Matters. Larry, fine sir, how are you?
Nice and toasty. How are you?
Toasty. I'm doing very well, thank you. We've had like a ton of rain, flash flood warnings, all kinds of stuff. It's very swampy here. Very humid for this area, period. Almost feels like Georgia, but not quite.
Well, I misquoted the temperature. It's only 95 here right now.
What did you say before?
93.
Oh, ooh. Those 2 degrees, man, that makes a big difference.
It very well could. 2 degrees of your body temperature could be fatal. If you have a fever at a certain level, it's very bad.
You are correct. Chance, good evening. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Doing very well. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, make sure you head over and press like, subscribe, 5-star rating. You know the drill. Does help us out. And if you want to be extra generous, then you can head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. Any level of support is incredibly valued, and we appreciate it, and we love you from the bottom of our hearts. Except for Larry's is kind of stone and very cold, so I don't know that he has one. It might be, just cold and hard. So what are we up to tonight, Larry?
Well, alrighty then. Stone and cold heart.
Just kidding.
So Chance, if you've heard him already, he's able to join us, so it means it's not just Mr. Doom and Gloom. We're going to talk about a new case that was just launched in Oklahoma. We're going to review that with a sort of a deep dive. And Chance has some kind of California corner. And also we have a brief segment from the United States Supreme Court that was submitted a couple weeks ago by a patron. We couldn't get to it last episode. So we're going to do a shallow dive on that case. And perhaps maybe some questions about the NARSOL conference that we would be having today if bad things hadn't happened.
Gotcha. Well, let's dive right in. As you said, we have this case. So it'll be a bit of a shallow dive, so to speak, from the Supreme Court. And it's Esteras. Is that, do you think I've pronounced that right?
Esteras. Yeah.
Esteras versus the United States. Eduardo Esteras pleaded guilty to conspiring to distribute heroin in the district court. And they sentenced him to 12 months in prison, followed by a 6-year term of supervised release. However, while on supervised release, Esteras was arrested and charged with domestic violence and, well, other crimes. The district court revoked Esteras' supervised release and ordered 24 months of re-imprisonment, explaining that Esteras' earlier sentence had been rather lenient and that his revocation sentence must promote respect for the law, a consideration enumerated in 18 U.S. Code, subsection 3553, and you can figure out the rest of it. That sounds like a bit of, like the district court had buyer's remorse, a little bit. What do you think, Chance?
Well, that's a possibility, or the district court that originally sentenced him leniently may have left the bench. But nonetheless, the Sixth Circuit affirmed, holding that a district court may consider section 3553, sub A, sub 2A, when revoking supervised release.
Well, then I guess the question is, in this case, for the Supreme Court, in determining whether to revoke supervised release, may a district court account for these omitted factors? And that's specifically the numbers and letters you read a moment ago, 3553A2A. Esteras says no. The government says yes. What did the high court say?
Well, they agreed with Esteras. District courts cannot consider section 3553A2A when revoking supervised release. The conclusion follows the well-established canon of statutory interpretation, expressio unius est exclusio alterius, which means that expressing one item of an associated group excludes another item not mentioned. And if you want to learn more about that, see Chevron USA Incorporated versus Eschalbal, 536 U.S. 7380, and that means at page 80. While Congress elsewhere set forth 10 factors that must generally inform a district court's sentencing decisions, It provided in Section 3583 sub e the provision governing the revocation of supervised release that courts must consider only 8 of those 10 factors. The natural implication is that Congress did not intend courts to consider the other two factors, including Section 3553A2A.
Do you mind, can you dig a bit deeper?
You want me to interpret that?
Oh, yes.
Okay. The statutory structure confirms this negative inference. Neighboring provisions governing the imposition and revocation of other kinds of sentences instructs courts to consider all three Section 3553A factors. But for supervised release and supervised release only, Congress omitted Section 3553A2A. And this is a distinction with a difference. And Congress's decision to exclude retribution from the calculus also comports with the supervised release role in the criminal justice scheme. Supervised release is not a punishment in lieu of incarceration, and that you get from the United States versus Granderson, 511 U.S. 3950. Rather, it fulfills rehabilitative ends and provides individuals with post-confinement assistance. United States versus Johnson, 529 U.S. 53, 59 to 60, if you are curious. And so, when a defendant violates a condition of supervised release, courts must consider the forward-looking sentencing ends, but may not consider the backward-looking purpose of retribution. And that's it in a nutshell.
So
interesting.
Let me try to understand this. So when a person has exited the Federal Bureau of Prisons on supervised release, we're no longer punishing them. Or the way you read here, the way this appears to read, we're assisting them. Is that correct?
That's right. It's all about rehabilitation. Correct.
So therefore, the United States Supreme Court seems to have spoken clearly that if you didn't get your pound of flesh, you can't, district judges, you don't get to have buyer's remorse. I see that here. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, you don't get a second shot. That's it.
And the district court could have fashioned such factors and additional conditions of supervised release, or I guess what I'm getting to was, could he or she have imposed incarceration as a part of the punishment for, or even is punishment a factor for violating terms of supervised release? Are you continuing trying to help the offender, or do you ever get to punish them when supervised release is not proving to be successful? I hope that question makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of complicated, but you know, I'm not sure exactly where you're going there, but maybe. You know, this post release is all about rehabilitation. So, you know, unless, and of course, if a person commits another crime or does something crazy, I think that's a whole new calculus.
So, well.
Well, my question is, how does this relate to registry matters?
Well, huh? it would relate to registry matters very easily, because a lot of our people are in federal custody. Then they have a period of supervised release that includes up into lifetime supervised release. So if this ties the hands of district courts to where if they have technical violations of supervised release that don't involve additional criminality, which can incarcerate them, that means that the judge can't get mad and say, well, I've given you a break already. I should have given you a way more back when you were sentenced originally. Now I'm going to punish you and slap you down good. This seems to limit the court's ability to be punitive when there's the condition of supervised release violated. That's what I'm reading from it.
That's what it looks like to me, but it, you know, it kind of doesn't make sense in a way, but it kind of does. Well, thanks to our Supreme Court.
All right, then. Well, as I understand it, since we will move along from there, as I understand it, Narsaw has filed a lawsuit this week in Oklahoma. Larry, are you prepared for a lively discussion on this one?
Not really.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just set it up, though, and you let me know when you're ready. So I read the complaint today while I was out walking. I wasn't mowing the lawn again because, I've been out of town. So I'm ready.
Well, I thought you told me you were using your Pushmore, and I was wanting you to show us the picture of the Pushmore you were using.
I did not prepare to have a Pushmore picture, and it's not the one that you think it is. It is not one of those manual jobs. I used one of those once. That was murder. I was very young. I was probably 30 or 40 years ago that I tried using that thing. I was like, what kind of moron uses this thing?
They used them for decades and decades before they had power mowers. I used one as a kid. We didn't have a power mower when I first started mowing grass.
Good grief. Chance, are you familiar with this push mower thing that has like the horizontally spinning thingamajigger?
Unfortunately, yeah. Now, I had a dad. you bet.
I have never, I don't even think as a kid we used that. We had a powered one, whatever.
Really?
Even if it wasn't self-propelled. But whatever. We had lawn service too, whatever. Anywho. Let's move along here, what this thing is. So paragraph one says, this is a civil rights class action challenging the constitutionality of Oklahoma statute annotated Title 46. Did I get the TIT right? I don't want to say TIT.
You did. Is that title? That's Title 47, yep.
Title 47. Why do you do this to me? Title 47, subsection 6-111E. Which requires the driver's licenses of individuals convicted of certain sexual offenses to be forever branded with the marking of sex offender. I've heard you pontificate for years that there are drawbacks when filing a class action. Please explain to me, Lucy.
Sure. One of the difficulties is getting the class certification that's needed. Class certification is covered in Federal Rules Civil Procedure 23.1. And one of the more of the members of a class may sue or be sued as representative parties only if the class is so numerous that joinder of all members is impractical. Two, there are questions of law or facts common to all class members. And three, the claims of the defenses of the representative parties are typical of the claims of the defenses of the class. And the representative parties will fairly and adequately be protected by the interest of the class, meaning the law firm, they have to be able to represent the class. If you're a solo practitioner and you've got a staff of just yourself and you've got a class that comprised of 6,000 plus members, you just might not be able to represent the class and effectively communicate the class with the class throughout the course of litigation. So getting the class certification is a problem. So that's one thing that bothers me, is that I don't know that this case is going to easily be certified. Hope it is, but it may be a problem getting the class certified.
Now, are you telling me that Oklahoma still marks driver's licenses despite the successful litigation in other states?
I am telling you that, yes.
Now, I would have thought that they would have discontinued the practice based on adverse decisions in other jurisdictions.
So I don't know why you would have thought that. Why would they do that? They need political cover of a court telling them that they can't do what they're doing if it's already ingrained in the statutory scheme. It's too risky politically to introduce legislation to help PFRs unless there's a hammer about to fall. So litigation is exactly the right thing to get the legislature to act, but you have to do legislation that'll actually win. And I'm not sure. I'm hoping this one's a great litigation, but that's what you have to do. The litigation is necessary. We just have to do the litigation very carefully, calculating and correctly.
And then going along, paragraph two states, plaintiffs individually and on behalf of all others so situated, citizens of Oklahoma allege that the challenged statutory requirements violates the First Amendment of the United States Constitution by requiring compelled speech. They collectively object to being forced to acquire and display a driver's license that brands them as a PFR and broadcasts the government's message that they are forever a danger to the public. Now, in your opinion, and possibly Chance too, is this compelled speech?
Yes, in my opinion, I would imagine that.
Yes, many
would prefer not to have the message broadcast on their driver's license, particularly considering the many instances where driver's license and IDs are required.
Now, who is Tom Tipton?
He's one of the defendants. He's named in his official capacity as Commissioner of the Oklahoma Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety is the entity responsible for enforcement and limitation of the PFR registration statute, which I don't feel like reading all that.
I read it earlier. 47 subsection 6-11E. Now, I noticed that one of the plaintiffs is the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws, NARSL. Do you have any concerns about being an organizational plaintiff?
Well, I do, but I'm on the team with this. It's a decision that was made by the team. But naming an organization opens up a new avenue of discovery for the state of Oklahoma. Since the courts are public, our enemies, such as the ones that are attacking us presently, can potentially obtain sensitive information, such as our numeric strength, maybe even financial stuff. But beyond that, we have an additional hurdle to overcome, establishing organizational standing. If I'm on the other side, I would insist on dragging out this case and forcing the two named organizations to show that how they're harmed. And it's Oklahoma Voices, or whatever the state affiliate chapter is, also is organizational plaintiff. So,
well, let's move on.
Do you have any thought on the organizational standing? Because I'm really dubious when we have to get into the weeds about organizational standing and all the stuff that opens up.
It's just complicated. But yeah, there's a lot of exposure there. Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, let's move on to what they challenged. Reading directly from the complaint, because I'm not a lawyer, it states, the department shall develop a procedure whereby a person applying for an original, renewal, or replacement class A, B, C, or D, I can do my alphabet. Now, that's A, B, C, or D class driver's license or identification card who's required to register as a PFR pursuant to the provisions of the PFR Registration Act, as an aggravated or habitual offender shall be issued a license or card bearing the words sex offender. I'm assuming that a habitual offender is a repeat offender. Now, what is an aggravated offender? Is he just one that's mad?
No.
The term aggravated applies to many registrants in the state and involves convictions against minors, incest, rape, sexual abuse, sodomy, lewd or indecent proposals to those under age 16. Essentially anything that involves a minor. So if you're online and you proposition a minor, that would qualify. So it's the whole universe of offenses. I don't know if it does the CP, but it does cover a big, broad umbrella of offenses.
The complaint points out that one's driver's license is frequently necessary in face-to-face encounters when cashing a check, using a credit card, visiting a health clinic or pharmacy, purchasing tobacco or alcohol, obtaining a job, entering some public buildings, and in air travel, just as a few examples. The PFR designation on the driver's license subjects the plaintiff to unnecessary public humiliation and shame. How did we get here in this fine, fine, fine United States?
Now, did you read that it said on the driver, does it say PFR or does it say something else on the driver's license?
It says something else. I was toning it down so we don't use the term over and over and over, but it says the sex offender word.
Oh, okay. Just being clear. Well, I hope Chance weighs in on this, but in my view, we've lost our moral compass. And how did we get there is beyond me. I would say that the victims' advocacy organizations have a lot to do with it, as well as sensationalized media reporting about PFRs and these type of offenses. But Chance, how the hell did we get in this position where we're willing to do this kind of thing to people?
I just don't know. I think I agree with you that we have lost our moral comfort, and it really puts the PFR in this, you know, in this mix. It's crazy.
I was having a conversation with my kid. God, was it yesterday? And he just turned 18, and talking to him about why don't the kids go out and play in the neighborhood and all this stuff. He's like, well, when I was a kid, they beat it into our heads about stranger danger and don't get into the white van where they're handing out candy. I was like, this is the biggest lie. Has it happened? The answer is probably yes. But that, like, once, twice in the whole country, in all of time, it's just ridiculous that they would run around and beat it into your head that you can't go out and play with your friends because someone's going to just drive by and scoop you up. Unless, of course, they're wearing masks and you happen to be brown and they're going to deport you. That's the only time you'd have to worry about it.
Yeah, true. True.
Well, we should also point out that unlike other residents who renew their licenses every 4 years, plaintiffs and PFRs must be reissued a branded driver's license annually at a cost of $38.50. When providing their license to verify their identity, the plaintiffs frequently encounter suspicion, fear, and revulsion. The message sent by the brand is that they are dangerous and pose a threat to the public. Now, why would you have to have that on your driver's license when you go to the clinic to get your annual physical exam? Like, there's no reason that the nurse needs to know. There's no reason that the doctor needs to know that you're PFR. I don't see the point of, other than shaming, why would they do this?
I don't know. We don't do it in my state. You'll have to ask the liberty-loving people and the individual liberty protectors that made the law in Oklahoma why they did it. I don't know.
Now, can you admit that this is a very bad situation?
No argument from me on that. The complaint states every time plaintiffs present their license, they're fearful that a common everyday occurrence will bring them and their family distress, ridicule, differential treatment, and even physical harm. And I agree with that. When you go hand your driver's license and it has that in big letters, I can't imagine, knowing how the human condition works, I can't imagine that they continue to treat you the same way that they would have treated you without that being there. I just can't say, this is just a normal everyday thing. He's a PFR. No, nothing. I mean, I would think that treatment changes dramatically.
So then along in paragraph 30, it is noted that the proposed class is numerous. There are approximately 6,700 individuals currently on the OK registry. Now, most registrants have been convicted of PFR type offenses that are classified as aggravated or habitual offender, and therefore are subject to the challenged condition. The numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy thresholds are met. Do you agree with them that the numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy thresholds are met as required by the federal court rule you cited earlier?
I do. I also agree with paragraph 31. It states joinder of all class members is impracticable. Not only is the class numerous, but membership in the class is constantly expanding every day. Additional people with convictions for PFR offenses or required state-issued identification cards or driver's licenses for everyday life and are subject to the challenge law. So when you join a class together, Chance may be able to expand on this, but when joinder happens, it's a known entity. It's not like you can't do joinder in this case because we don't know who to be will be joining the case. So you just have to, if you're going to let the group proceed, you would have to certify it as a class because we don't know until each day passes when they put more people on the PFR registry who's in the class. Chance, am I missing anything?
No, that's right. I think that's the right analysis.
So to come up with an alternate scenario is, what was it, in the 90s, maybe early 2000s, where there were the Ford Explorers that had Firestone tires that were blowing up and the things were rolling all over the place. And that was a class suit. And you would know precisely the number of people that had those cars with that batch number from those tires. So this is the scenario that you're just describing, that you would be able to know exactly how many people have those cars with those tires.
That would be correct. We don't know who else is going to be in this class because it's continuously fluid and changing. Some are dying, so they probably wouldn't need the protection of the class.
They might. You never know.
I've never heard of anybody being, when they're dead, they don't usually require anything else out of a PFR.
This is a very broadly defined class, honestly.
All right. Well, then, so paragraph 32 states that there are questions of law and fact common to all class members, including but not limited to the following. What are the rationales for the law? Oh, that's to shame and blame. Whether there is any compelling interest served by the law? None. Has the state adopted the least restrictive means to accomplish that end? That is definitely a no. Whether the law violates any constitutional protections of the First Amendment? We just throw that out the window. Who cares? What is your take on how the court will answer those questions?
It's complicated, to say the least. It depends on the level of scrutiny they choose to apply. If they decide to apply strict scrutiny, the outcome will be better for us. If it's merely a rational basis review, we lose.
Please tell me, expand on that, and how does one fare better than the other?
Well, in a rational basis review, it is, you'd reflect back to question number one, what are the rationales for the law? And this is so confusing for the non-legal mind. The non-legal people believe that there has to be data that shows that the law works. There doesn't have to be one iota of data for a rational basis review. that review encompasses the question of, was the legislature, the lawmaking body, did they have a rational basis of something that they wanted to do? Whether they achieved the desired result is not relevant. There is a rational basis to try to protect the community from PFRs. So if you have that lowest level of scrutiny, this case goes down the crapper. But if you have strict scrutiny, where it comes into where you have to apply the least restrictive means possible, and you get into a much narrower opportunity for the state to escape with this. It would be very bad for us unless this is reviewed strict scrutiny. And Chance can probably expand those answers a little bit, but the rational basis will get us down the crapper is what it'll do.
Yeah, anything can justify rational basis, but you know, you've got the First Amendment here, so you know that may give you a better shot.
And what determines whether they apply strict or rational basis?
Or intermediate scrutiny.
Yeah, okay. To add the third one in there, what determines which level of scrutiny that they use?
Well, I think first and, you know, at the front of all this would be a very important constitutional right, like the First Amendment.
But who determines that? Does the judge determine that?
Well, you're going to have to have pretty cohesive arguments, and it's going to have to be pretty clear, and the court's going to have to recognize that that's exactly what it is to get that kind of scrutiny.
Well, I think I figured that where he's trying to go. The briefing will help the court. The Narsal and the Oklahoma Voices attorney will be arguing that this is a matter for strict scrutiny, and they'll be telling the court briefing why it should be strict scrutiny. The state will be saying just the opposite. They will be saying that this is only a rational basis review, and ultimately the federal district judge will decide what level of scrutiny, and then ultimately when it goes up on appeal, because regardless of which side wins on appeal, it's very likely, ultimately the Tenth Circuit will decide that. But so it will be briefed below, argued below, and then the level of scrutiny will be decided by the district judge.
Right. Gotcha. And if the court thinks it's a First Amendment issue, you know, you're out of rational basis land, I believe.
All right, well then, in paragraph 38, the complaint alleges that Oklahoma statute, the same thing that we've been talking about, is unconstitutional, both on its face and as applied to plaintiffs, because it compels plaintiffs and all similar class members to engage in speech and communicate the government's message in violation of the First Amendment. Now, do you believe that this statute to be facially unconstitutional, Larry?
No, I do not believe it to be facially unconstitutional at all. Remember that for something to be deemed facially unconstitutional, there must be no set of circumstances in which it could be done. So we can eliminate this as being facially unconstitutional just by understanding the very case that went to the Supreme Court called Broderick versus Oklahoma. I'm pretty sure that originated from Oklahoma, where they...
What makes you say that?
I'm fairly certain that it did, but I can't remember all the details of the case. But I think there are a number of ways to mark driver's licenses that would pass constitutional muster. We mark driver's licenses all the time. We mark underage driver's licenses. We mark those with DWI convictions while they're required to have an interlock license here in our state. We mark the licenses of those who must wear corrective lenses. So marking driver's license is perfectly fine, but this marking here is the problem. So at best, this is going to be as applied. They're not going to issue an order and say that there's no set of circumstances where PFR licenses can ever be marked, because you can mark it very discreetly. Rather than having that big orange sexual offender on the license, you could have it in a code that only law enforcement would be able to access. So I think they lose on that one.
Well, of course, Mr. Doom and Gloom is certainly present tonight, and we need to move along. There will be updates as this case progresses. What kind of timeline? What's next? Tell me what happens moving forward.
Well, the first part of the process is the complaint has to be served on the respondents, the defendants. And there's an easy way to do service, and there's a harder way to do service. And the defendants that are named can agree to accept service and waive service and say that the electronic filing is sufficient, or they can require that you track them down and come in and hand them a paper copy. That hasn't changed to my knowledge. So they, once they're served, they'll have 30 days to file a answer and response. And even though it's federal court, states always manage to get an extension by claiming that they're overworked, understaffed. So we need to be patient. Audience, please be patient. Don't reach out to NARSL's attorney. Don't reach out to the partner attorney that provides us Pro Hoc Vici admission. We don't know anything. We won't know anything for some period of time. All you're doing is bogging them down with unnecessary stuff. We will report as soon as we have something to report.
Is this one of those like Miriam Ackerman 10-year fights?
Yes, this could be very well a 2 or 3 year fight.
Okay. All righty then. Well, let's head over to dum-da-da-dum.
Well, before we get to that, has the rules for service changed any? That's the way I remember it about 15 years ago, last time I did a federal court case.
I haven't looked at that lately, but you know, they're dynamic. They could have.
But yeah.
Yeah. So, I'd have to, I mean, that's something you want to look at before you do, right? Look before you do, but I don't know.
Well, they can't waive formal service and accept it as served just by receiving the complaint and say we waive service. That I'm sure has not changed. But if they want to play hardball, they'll say good service.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, let's move to California Corner, titled Courts in Crisis, the Legal Path to Authoritarianism. Because you guys talked about it.
Authoritarianism.
Because you guys talked about it in pre-show, I would probably have been able to pull it off, but you guys messed up my noodle.
Okay.
So today we're diving into a critical and chilling topic, how courts, the very institutions meant to uphold justice, can transform tools into tyranny. Now joining me as always in this section is Chance Oberstein, a criminal defense attorney with decades of experience analyzing judicial systems and their role in society. Welcome back, Chance. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you, Andy. This is, you know, it's not my typical sex crimes defense podcast. So this is a bit more serious. It's not just shop talk and interesting topics. This is important. Very, very, very important. So, you know, this is a topic that's not just historical. It's deeply relevant to the challenges we face today, even the stuff we just talked about.
All right. Well, let's start with a little bit of a history lesson. How did the German courts enable Hitler's rise to power?
Well, you know, believe me, this is controversial stuff, but let's start out. Let's start out with Germany, because it's probably the best illustration. The German judiciary played a pivotal role in legitimizing Hitler's regime. After Hitler became chancellor in 1933, the courts didn't resist, they adapted. Judges embraced Nazi ideology, interpreting laws to align with the regime's goals. For example, they upheld emergency measures under Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution and allowed Hitler to suspend civil liberties and suppress opposition without parliamentary consent. The legal compliance gave his actions a veneer of legitimacy.
And then the courts weren't overthrown. They willingly supported the regime, probably because they thought they would die. But
well, yeah, exactly. That's the whole point. They became political. The judiciary accepted the shift from a normative state governed by established laws, the rule of law, to a prerogative state where Hitler's will overrode legal norms. Judges enforced laws like the Nuremberg Laws, which institutionalized racial discrimination. And in many cases, They went beyond the letter of the law to fulfill Nazi objectives, showing how the rule of law can be hollowed out from within.
Now, I will say that that's terrifying. Were there any efforts within the judiciary to resist?
Absolutely. There were isolated cases of resistance, but they were rare and often crushed. The Nazi regime purged Jewish judges and those who were deemed politically unreliable, replacing them with individuals sympathetic to Nazi ideology or willing to conform. Legal education was also reshaped to reflect Nazi racial and political doctrines, ensuring future generations of judges were indoctrinated. Does that start to hit some nerves?
It does to me. Then the courts didn't just tolerate tyranny, they actively helped build its legal framework?
Precisely. It was a stark reminder that when those entrusted with justice prioritize obedience over principle, the legal system can become a tool for oppression.
Now let's broaden the lens a little bit. How does this compare to other authoritarian regimes like China or Russia and, dare I say, North Korea?
The pattern is strikingly similar. In China, the legal system is designed to reinforce state control rather than limit it. Courts are subordinate to the Communist Party, and laws are intentionally vague, giving authorities broad power to suppress dissent. The state even promotes legal literacy among citizens, not to empower them, but to increase compliance and bolster legitimacy.
And then what about over there in the former Soviet Union, now known as Russia?
Right. In Putin's Russia, the judiciary often serves as a stage for political repression. We've seen this time again on the news. You can watch it in real time. High-profile trials of opposition figures are used to signal the regime's dominance. While the legal system appears functional on the surface, it's tightly controlled behind the scenes, with outcomes often predetermined. It's less about justice and more about maintaining the regime's grip on power.
And then what about Iran? And God, I keep thinking of the song from the Beach, well, not the Beach Boys, the parody song back in the day.
Bomb,
bomb, bomb, bomb, bomb, Iran. Sorry, couldn't
resist. Yeah, bomb, bomb. Yeah, right. Well, you know, their legal system blends Islamic law with authoritarian governance. The judiciary is heavily influenced by religious authorities, or zealots, and laws are interpreted to maintain clerical power. Dissent is criminalized under broad charges like spreading corruption on earth, giving the regime sweeping powers to silence critics. In these cases, the legal system becomes a facade, maintaining the appearance of order while serving authoritarian ends.
So whether it's ideological, political, or religious, the courts are used to legitimize control?
That's the whole point, exactly. It's a global tactic. Authoritarian regimes use legal systems to consolidate power while maintaining the illusion of rule of law. In comparison, democratic governments use legal systems to diversify power to uphold the rule of law. It's the complete opposite, thus ensuring full equality before the law and strong civil liberties.
You guys are talking a bunch of mumbo jumbo. Let's bring this closer to home.
Here comes the Republican. Okay, come on.
Some scholars are drawing comparisons between authoritarian legal tactics abroad and what's happening in the U.S. under this administration. What is your perspective? Because I've heard this quite a bit, that the courts are being corrupted and taken over. And, you know, I'm not ready to buy into it, but I want to hear what you think.
Well, you know, there are certainly parallels, and they're concerning. I mean, Trump expanded executive power, often testing constitutional limits, and I think we've all seen that. For example, he invoked emergency powers in unprecedented ways, repurposed obscure laws to justify controversial actions, and declared parts of the southern border a national defense area. These moves echo legal manipulation seen in these types of authoritarian regimes.
But we have clearly a constitutional established judicial independence of the judiciary and a co-equal branch of government.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very rational, right? Because that's what we're hearing. But actually, Trump undermined judicial independence by publicly attacking judges and delegitimizing court rulings that went against him. He surrounded himself with loyalists, creating a perception that he was unconstrained by the Constitution and federal statutes. Legal experts have raised alarms about this erosion of norms.
Well, but we still have due process of law here. This is not like in Putin's Russia or in the country of Iran. And here we have...
Right. His administration curtailed due process in areas like immigration, pushing for mass deportations with limited or no legal recourse. Additionally, litigating birthright citizenship protections, moves that mirror legal marginalization seen only in these authoritarian states. I mean, you'd have to be blind not to see it.
You can't say that people that aren't born here have all these same rights, can you? I mean, they weren't born here, Chance. Can't you understand that?
Well, I wasn't saying that. I was saying people with birthright citizenship protections are now on the chopping block.
Oh, okay. Right. All right. Well, yes, I do think that there's a challenge underway to eliminate the birthright citizenship.
Correct.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
The decision came out yesterday. The decision came out, and the Supreme Court kicked it back down to the lower courts. They have 30 days to do something with it. So the court did not rule against him.
So I'm not familiar with that, but go ahead. I didn't mean to cut your time
off. No, I wanted to dig into that a little bit. What makes any of us a citizen at that point? It's because we were born here. It's not because of anything else. We were born on some kind of U.S. territory, soil, whether that's in the U.S. or on a military base in another country or something like that. That's how we all got our citizenship. How's that any different?
Well, that's right. By extension, that's the argument.
But their argument is that if you're lugged across the border, not lugged across the border, but if the person illegally come across the border, why would they be rewarded with their offspring when they get here 35 minutes before the baby is going to be born? Why should they be awarded with citizenship? That's their argument.
Well, sure, but that's what would have happened 100 years ago when the mass influx of people were coming from Europe. They all showed up, no paperwork, nothing, had their names changed because you couldn't pronounce the full German name or, a Polish name or whatever it was when you got here. And then you pop out a kid. Poof. Kid is a citizen. I don't see a difference at all in this case.
Yeah, well, that certainly is the debate, isn't it?
Yep. And of course, so then the courts have pushed back, haven't they?
Well, yes, and that was a key difference until the federal courts were neutered yesterday, as you say. Unlike fully authoritarian states, the U.S. system of checks and balances was still functioning. Many of Trump's most aggressive legal maneuvers were challenged and often blocked by the judiciary. However, yesterday, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court issued a major ruling that limits the power of federal courts to block executive orders nationwide. In a 6-3 decision, the court held that the federal district judges cannot issue universal or nationwide injunctions that halt executive actions for everyone, not just the plaintiffs in the case. The ruling basically says that lower courts cannot block what appears to be unconstitutional executive orders across the entire country. And in my opinion, this erosion of legal norms is real. And the debate remains as to whether we are, as Paul Simon might say, slip-sliding away into authoritarianism.
What lessons do you think that we can learn from history to protect judicial independence?
Well, I think the biggest lesson is that the courts must prioritize principle over obedience. Judges and legal scholars have a duty to resist legal or political pressure to uphold the rule of law. Transparency, accountability, and public engagement are also crucial. When citizens understand and defend their legal systems, it becomes harder for authoritarianism to take root.
And then, of course, in this fine democracy, what role do citizens play in this?
Well, citizens are the ultimate safeguard. They must stay informed, hold leaders accountable, and demand judicial independence. History shows us that complacency is dangerous. When people stop defending their rights, authoritarianism can creep in.
Do you think that there are any warning signs we should be looking for?
Yes, absolutely so. Look, just like yesterday, look for efforts to undermine judicial independence, expand executive power, and curtail due process, all the things we've been talking about here. These are red flags that the legal system is being manipulated for political ends. It's essential to push back against these trends before they become normalized and entrenched.
Well, those are some powerful reminders. Who has some final thoughts on this? Chance, go first.
Well, just this, the rule of law is fragile. It's not just about the laws on paper, it's about people committed to justice. History shows us the dangers of complacency and we must remain vigilant. Courts can be a bulwark against tyranny, but only if they remain independent and principled.
What do you think, Larry?
I like that, and I continue to want to cling to my belief that I'm starting to slip away, as you said, slip sliding away. But I want to believe that after 250 years of this experiment that we've been undertaking, that at some point there will be a pushback saying, no, we're not going to let 250 years of people dying to defend our system to be corrupted by an individual or a small group of individuals. If I stop believing that, there's hardly any point to live. At some point, people have got to realize that this is a danger, that we're seeing some unprecedented things happening now.
Totally agree with you. Totally agree with you.
Well, this started even as far back as Obama, and I'm sure before that, but this is kind of like when I started paying attention, is that during the Obama administration, sure, you can say it was their prerogative, but they held all those federal judiciary ships, judgeships from being appointed. And then when Trump took office, Mitch McConnell was, man, like, can we get as many of the most conservative, the youngest judges in place that we can in these 4 years? And this is all the fruits of that labor.
Yes, it's kind of amazing if you think about it, because that's where the pushback came from. They're judges. So
this is a 15-year, even longer than that, almost 20-year cycle that we're finally bearing the fruit of.
Well, the whole idea, I think, was to put, you know, to install the framework where everything, you know, rolls fairly well, where everything goes with the flow. And you know what? No matter if the judge was a Trump-appointed judge or an Obama judge or whoever judge, you know, judges have been pushing back. And the federal courts have become a real dilemma in terms of trying to, you know, neuter, you know, the courts in general and impose, you know, an executive's political will on the people. And that's the way it should be. But, you know, here we are.
All right, then. Larry, do you want to do this one last little bit that you dropped in there?
Sure. This was a letter that was sent to Narsal. And it's really not per se a question, but it's more of a comment about stuff. So I just thought we could read the guy that sent it, his name, William.
All right. Well, in your recent newsletter, I read about your hiring a lawyer on the team. It made me wonder about an approach I've never seen advocated for, but I think could potentially get some traction in the courts. Given the fact this nation was formed as a rebellion against taxation without representation, it is the peak of hypocrisy that PFR laws legalize taxation without representation. We are required, as all our taxpayers, to pay taxes that go toward recreation options, parks, education, those are schools. Now, however, not only are we prohibited from enjoying the benefit of our tax money, but we're also banned by law from ever seeing what our money is spent on. This is simply another form of taxation without representation. While it is true that some other taxpayers may choose not to use or utilize the aforementioned facilities, PFRs are afforded no choice due to living and use restrictions. If Narsal would consider taking up the matter with some small jurisdiction, the organization could build some precedent. Perhaps it would allow for bigger wins in larger jurisdictions. Or, in the event of a loss, Narsal could move right up to a higher court on appeal. You may publish this if you choose, or simply write back, whichever you prefer. All I ask is you use only my first name if published. Interesting point.
Yes, and I did write William back, and I told him that I didn't know if we're going to publish it, but we're going to talk about it. And I posed a question to him because I don't understand this logic for what would be the benefit of taking the matter up on challenge in a smaller jurisdiction. He's got to have some logic that he's thinking, but I was unable to. It didn't.
Would it be easier? Would it cost less? Are there any, you know, is it then it doesn't gain a lot of attention by finding a tiny little district that has a tiny little park and you could go challenge that and win in a really low innocuous. It's not the right word, but something like that. A little insignificant. That's the word. Court system.
Well, maybe that's what he's thinking. But the way I'm thinking, if we go into what is our smallest state in population, maybe Wyoming or Alaska, if we go into one of those small states, they're not going to throw in the towel. They're big enough that they're going to push back on anything that we challenge. And then if we're in federal court, it's going to go to the Circuit Court of Appeals. Is Wyoming in the 10th or the 9th? I know Colorado is based in Denver. I don't know but we're going to end up in federal court in all likelihood. So I'm just not sure what its logic is. But I do agree with them that this is really bad that you pay taxes on all these things that you're forbidden to use. You're not making a choice.
Is it possible to use something like even like a little tiny city park or something like that that has, is that possible to attack something like this from that angle where it's just the tiniest, smallest little, even a little county court?
Well, if you're getting at the, if there's municipal ordinances that you're talking about challenging, because a lot of, there's a hopscotch, a checkerboard of places where they're not forbidden, they have restrictions. But even if you're fighting a city of 10,000-15,000 people, they're going to have a city yep. attorney or a county attorney. They may decide at some point to stop the bleeding and quit spending money, but they're going to want to defend their ordinance. They're not going to, just because the PFR doesn't like it, they're not going to say, well, yeah, we followed, we should have thought about it. They're just not going to do that. My experience in government,
I think that's the example that he's going after, though.
Yeah, well, that might make some sense to him, but to some degree, he might be right, because that's kind of what happened down in Butts County with our Halloween. Remember, the yep. sheriff said, I'm going to take this to the Supreme Court.
I do recall him saying that.
Well,
the other county, they settled.
Well, they were a little more rational to begin with. That was a neighboring county of Spalding. But the Butts County commissioners told the sheriff that, you can do this. We can't stop you under Georgia law. You can force us to spend the money, but we can also let the voters of Butts County know that their taxes are going up because of you. And,
that's a good angle. And, very good angle.
He decided he didn't want to go to the Supreme Court after all, so he stopped the battle, because it was probably going to be a loss at the Supreme Court, which would have been even a bigger precedent than what our precedent is now in the 11th Circuit, which is being used over in the 8th Circuit in Missouri by another organization that's based in the western United States that came rushing in to use the work that we had done to try to...
Who shall remain nameless, right?
Yeah.
So we were in the development process of a case, and that organization asked us not to do it because they had it already. But that same organization did not want that challenge to be done. They were not nearly as enamored when I wanted to do, but they did help. To their credit, they did write an amicus brief on that. But we challenged it with our money, and when we won it, then other people want to ride the. But that's done, Chance. The ACLU does the same thing. They do the
well, you know, time. It's just like the Israeli war. Let the Israelis do all the work and then jump into the last minute and take credit for it.
Okay, then.
So,
are we done?
We are done, but I really appreciate Will Williamson in that, because it's horrendous, all the restrictions. We don't really have any here. A PFR can do anything and be anywhere anybody can be, except for when they're under supervision. But a lot of states, there's so many things they can't do, including raise their children, engage them yep. with their child's education. Beyond, they can't even go watch them play sports at a 5,000-seat arena.
I hear from Super Patron Mike in Florida pretty regularly, and he, like, just constantly, he's just reminded almost every day of all the garbage that has to happen. He gets, I don't know if it's, I guess maybe it's just quarterly that they do door knocking, and they come by at night with the freaking lights on, blaring around, like all the people in the neighborhood would see it. Like, what is the freaking point? The guy's been living there for, I don't know, like 10 years or something like that. He hasn't moved. He's got a super stable job where he's been for forever. Why bother this guy every quarter?
Right.
Because they're getting paid to do it. They're getting government funds from the big, large federal government that they say is too large, and that they would like to see it spending less money. But those very conservative sheriffs are reaching out to the large federal government to get those compliance dollars. Isn't that amazing? One of the many contradictions.
And then they're talking out of the other side of their mouth, saying how much they hate that people take money from the federal government.
Yes, but we could spend hours talking about that. But we do have an yep. announcement to make that we won't be here next weekend. So all the people that are glued to their computer waiting for us, we're going to be out of commission next weekend.
And is anything happening specifically? Is it a holiday or something?
Well, it is, but I think that one of our key people is traveling, right?
I am not traveling. I just have company coming.
Okay.
Well, very good. Chance, thank you, as always, for joining us.
Pleasure.
We got
pleasure.
A new patron named Dale. Welcome, my friend. I sent you a message over there in the Patreon system to say welcome aboard. Head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes and all that stuff. Oh, wait, before we do all of that, Chance, what are you doing these days? You got a little side project?
I do. I've got a podcast going.
All right. Do you want to tell us about it real quick?
Well, it's called Sex Crimes Defense Podcast, and it's shop top about what's happening, trends across the United States. It's discussions about cases that are coming up here and there. It's a mix of a social media perspective versus legal analysis, and it's kind of a cool deal. Come join
Very
me.
Good.
Come listen.
Well, how would they find you, Chance? What do they need to do to find that podcast?
Just put Chance Oberstein Sex Crimes Defense Podcast. It's a YouTube channel. They'll find me.
Okay.
And so it's not available on a podcast app, only on YouTube?
I'm not sure if it's available on podcast apps, but definitely on YouTube because it's a YouTube channel. All right.
Well, I've got a question for our head. What is it? HM, whatever it is. Yeah, I got a question for you. I was watching a YouTube channel, and they have the channel itself has a link to, on the YouTube channel, they have a link to their Patreon, and they say, please support us on Patreon. Is that permissible on YouTube? Because it is, we need to do that, because we've got a fair number of people that view YouTube.
It's on there. It's in the show notes. It's in the, if they
I
click
don't know
on more,
if that
it's
is
in
or
there.
Not, but
no, but I'm saying
it is reasonable.
In the comments, they have a highlighted comment that says, support us on Patreon, and then they have the link so that they can just click that and go directly to Patreon from the YouTube.
I will tell you again, it's in the notes, a link to take you directly to the page. It's been there on just about every episode, but I don't make any comments about it, but I could.
So, okay. All right.
All right. Registrymatters.co. RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com, 747-227-4477, and then, of course, patreon.com/registrymatters. Gentlemen, I hope you have a fantastic 4th of July. Stay warm, all that fun stuff over there, and stay out of trouble. Larry, stay out of trouble. Oh, God, that's the wrong one. Wrong button. We don't need any hypocrisy quotes here.
Right.
Have a good night, gentlemen.
You good too. Night. Thanks.
You've been listening to FYP.